You are listening to WPVMLP 103.7 in Asheville, North Carolina.
From Feature Story News in the UK, I'm John Beaver. Donald Trump has questioned the future of NATO if US allies fail to help reopen a key shipping lane in the Middle East. Iran has effectively closed the Strait of Hormuz, a crucial route for global supplies of gas and oil. The US president says it's only appropriate the beneficiaries of the strait help to make sure nothing bad happens there. But Dr. John Strawson, a law professor specialising in the Middle East, says Donald Trump's plan isn't quite clear.
It's not just a question of sending a few ships. The Straits of Hormuz is very narrow. We're talking of something in the region of a width that goes down to 24 miles, and the Iranians control all the coast. So sending quite a large number of ships wouldn't necessarily mean that you'd be able to open the straits and keep it going. I mean, what we're talking about is trying to get 90 ships a day as opposed to about 2 to 5 going through these straits to keep the international economy going. But you'd need a properly planned military operation.
Meanwhile, India's foreign minister says diplomacy with Iran over the strait is working as New Delhi scrambles to keep cooking gas flowing to more than a billion people. Ishan Gurg tells us more from New Delhi.
Minister S. Jaishankar says it is more productive to reason and coordinate with Tehran rather than avoid engagement, though he cautions there is no blanket deal yet, with ship movements still being handled case by case. India imports around 60% of its LPG and nearly 90% of those shipments pass through the Strait of Hormuz. 22 Indian vessels remain stranded west of the strait, and New Delhi is pushing for their safe passage. Reports say the government has ordered refiners to maximize domestic cooking gas output and set up a round-the-clock control room to track supplies. But analysts warn any prolonged conflict could still severely test India's energy security.
The United States and China have resumed bilateral talks on Monday after a first day of face-to-face meetings in Paris. The two sides are discussing economic issues and the expected summit in China at the end of the month between Donald Trump and Xi Jinping. Ross Cullen reports.
The talks are into the second day as planned, and they are addressing the trade truce between the two sides to see if they can agree to remove or at least lower tariffs on each other's economies. The war in Iran also expected to feature again after President Trump asked China to help secure the Strait of Hormuz. On Monday, the Chinese Foreign Ministry said Beijing is, quote, committed to promoting the easing and cooling down of the situation. The US and Chinese delegations are mostly focused on preparations for the planned presidential summit between Donald Trump and Xi Jinping. Washington says Trump will visit China from March the 31st to the 2nd of April, though Beijing has yet to confirm those dates in line with its standard practice.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks, looking all this week at various aspects of the US and Israel's war on Iran, starting today with one big winner who can already be identified from the conflict. It's Russian President Vladimir Putin. The Americans have lifted sanctions on his oil in an effort to drive the global price of the commodity down, and the war has benefited the Russian leader in a number of other ways, according to Sir Robin Niblett, Distinguished Fellow and former Director of Chatham House in London.
He's definitely better off now than he was at the start of the war, mainly because of the price of oil. So everything they're selling, and they're still selling what they were selling before, is at, you know, a 30 to 40% price higher than it was. The second element, of course, is that America is expending a lot of political capital on this war. Difficult relationships, even more difficult now with its allies. It may end up with much more cautious relationship with its Gulf allies as well. They weren't all behind this conflict and feel that maybe America's been pulled into Israel's pocket on it. You know, it may gain in influence by seeing America lose influence. And then in the end, America's spending a lot of money on weaponry that can't be spent somewhere else. It can't be given to Ukraine. And obviously it can't be used in the Pacific area either. So if you look at the balance of forces, yeah, Russia is gaining.
Tomorrow, the impact of the war on Iran's cultural sites and sites of antiquity. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
To recap the top stories, Donald Trump has questioned the future of NATO if US allies fail to help reopen the Strait of Hormuz. He's called on all who benefit from the key shipping lane to protect it from Iranian attacks. Meanwhile, India's foreign minister says diplomacy with Iran to allow their ships to move through the strait is working as New Delhi scrambles to keep cooking gas flowing for more than a billion people. And the United States and China are resuming bilateral talks on Monday after a first day of face-to-face meetings in Paris.
Here's your Radio Asheville weather report. Big changes in progress throughout the course of the day as temperatures fall. We will see readings by the evening time back to about 36. Some scattered rain showers could even mix with a little bit of slushy snow. Overnight, skies are cloudy. Temperatures first thing tomorrow morning back to about 20, but the wind chill factor in the teens and even colder on a gusty northwest wind. Tomorrow, sunny, windy, the high temperature only 37 degrees. Wind chill factors in the 20s. I'm Bob Kukin on Radio Asheville 103.7.
Hello, folks. Thanks for joining us on Head Inside Mental Health, featuring conversations about mental health and substance use treatment with experts, advocates, and professionals from across the country sharing their thoughts and insights on the world of behavioral health care. Broadcasting on WBBM 103.7, the voice of Asheville Independent Commercial Free Radio. I'm Todd Weatherly, your host, therapeutic consultant, behavioral health expert. It is my pleasure to welcome friend and treatment professional, Dr. Greg Chasson. With his PhD in clinical psychology from the University of Houston, Dr. Chasson is a full professor and licensed board-certified psychologist at the University of Chicago. He is one of the world's leading authorities on transforming compulsive and impulsive behaviors with an international reputation as an in-demand professional trainer. As an active scholar, Dr. Chasson has published 70-plus scientific publications and carried out grant-funded research projects in the field of OCD and related disorders. Greg is also author of an award-winning leadership book on perfectionism called Flawed, Why Perfectionism is a Challenge for Management, available at flawedbook.com and wherever print, e, and audiobooks are sold. Dr. Chasson, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you taking the time today. And I'm, you know, we got to meet, I guess it's now a couple of years ago, almost 3 years ago, mm-hmm. when you presented at a conference, the Autism Research Conference down in Hollywood Beach, that's sponsored and put on by the folks down there at New Directions for Young Adults. Yep. And they have you come in because the people who are on the spectrum, that's their population, of course, really do suffer from a lot of OCD.
Yep.
But the first time I got to see you, which was really, really cool, was when you got to talk about the topic that's here in your book, which is Flawed, Why Perfectionism is a Challenge for Management, which yes. is cool. I've gotten to dip into it. I'm not finished yet, but I've dipped into it. But, you know, the whole, like, quote, perfectionism is the enemy of good, and that it prevents people from getting things accomplished. Give me the... You know, I also happen to know you well enough because we got to presented again at the same conference and I got to present there as well. You and I sat down for dinner and our wives talked more than we did, which is great. But
they
you also
carried the conversation, didn't they?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean,
you're frozen.
My social collateral kind of goes up whenever I bring my wife to things. So they like,
yeah, well, that's
like
why
me better.
I bring my wife to things. Yes.
Right? Exactly. So, you know, the thing that occurs to me and the thing that you were talking about is this, you know, as perfectionism is this challenge for management principles. Mm-hmm. And that you've taken that over to serving some pretty complex. I mean, your work serves pretty complex individuals. Like you work with some of like people that are really struggling really hard. Yeah. What is it that caused you to jump over to produce this book and kind of take it to a management principles area? Like what did you, where was the start point and where was the parallel? What got you started?
That's a great question because that Todd tells me how much you are in sync and in tune with the mental health profession and the community, because I don't know that I've ever gotten a similar question like that from your standard podcaster, because to them, they don't see that this is a direct translation from a clinical world into something that is more of a lay world. And so that question doesn't even come to their mind, but I'm happy to answer it because it was a happy sort of development and evolution. I mean, I'm in the world of OCD, obsessive compulsive disorder. I direct the clinical services, the psychosocial services over at the University of Chicago as a faculty member and psychologist. And we see some of the most severe cases of obsessive compulsive disorder and related conditions, things like health anxiety, hoarding, body dysmorphic disorder, skin picking, hair pulling, and just OCD proper, which can get extremely severe. And part of the OCD spectrum is severe instances of perfectionism and getting stuck on fear of making mistakes and being responsible for bad things happening. And so it's not synonymous with OCD perfectionism, but if you think about a Venn diagram, you have OCD and you have perfectionism that overlap. And in that center, it's a ton of overlap. Not everyone with OCD has perfectionism, and not everyone with perfectionism has OCD. But it is this area that drew me because of my own personal experience with perfectionism growing up that I'm happy to talk about. But also professionally in the world of OCD, you see it a ton. And so it is something that I've worked on clinically and personally for years. And I have this entire framework based on evidence-based approach from a cognitive behavioral perspective that really, I think, provides a very palatable way of thinking about perfectionism that patients really gravitate to. And so when I was teaching my students how to provide treatment for perfectionism, at one point they stopped me down. They're like, dude, because all my students call me dude.
Right, of course.
Dude, you should write this down. And that's when I started thinking, oh, maybe I should. And
that's a good idea.
Yeah. And so I wrote it down. But as I was writing, I was like, I can't write this for everyone on the planet. I need to kind of come up with an audience, a domain for applying this. And I thought of leadership and workplace, because that's where you see this a lot. And, you know, it wasn't really a huge stretch to translate a lot of the clinical terms and phenomena to the workplace setting to provide a guide and roadmap for people who might see this in the workplace.
Now, this never, and it doesn't really, it did not register with me until you just said it, that perfectionism and OCD are different. And yes, that there's, you know, they have this big Venn diagram crossover, and they've got a lot of territory they share with one another. What's the difference between perfectionism and obsessive compulsive disorder? What is the difference in your mind? And clinically speaking, you know, what's the definition?
Yeah, perfectionism really can be multifaceted in that you don't necessarily need to have traditional obsessions and compulsions. The thoughts that come to you don't need to feel intrusive or like they're invading into your territory. That's the characteristic of OCD, right? You're walking around and all of a sudden you have a thought that attacks you that feels inconsistent with who you are and what you want to be thinking about. That is OCD obsessions in a nutshell, right? And then you do things to try to calm yourself when those thoughts strike. So you try to engage in behaviors to neutralize them. You wash excessively if you have an intrusive thought about getting sick, or if you have a thought about murdering someone that makes you feel appalled and horrible as a human, you might do things to protect yourself or the people around you. Maybe you hide all the knives in your house, or you avoid certain people that you have thoughts about. And so those are very classic, what we call ego dystonic, which is basically saying that they're not consistent with what you want to be thinking about. They're very alien to you, and they're very disturbing. Some people with perfectionism have those types of perfectionistic thoughts. I got to do this right or bad things will happen. It feels alien to them. It feels really inconsistent with what they want to be thinking about. But on the other hand, there's a lot of people with perfectionism where their thoughts are completely consistent with their worldview, right? It's not alien to them. It's not intrusive. They have thoughts of, this just is the way the world works. I need to have this perfect. I cannot make mistakes. I should do it this way and I shouldn't do it that way. Those kinds of thoughts are not aligned with an OCD way of thinking, right? OCD is very intrusive and inconsistent. And so you have types of perfectionism that don't map on to OCD very well. And then, of course, there's OCD that doesn't have any connection with perfectionism, right? That you have people fearing all sorts of things that has nothing to do with responsibility and fear of mistakes. And so there really isn't a perfect overlap, but there is a lot of overlap sometimes.
Well, it's, you know, in working with clients that we serve and on the mental health side, I've certainly, you know, been witness to clients. And I had one client who suffered from pretty terrible schizophrenia, and he suffered from OCD, and he's a big baseball fan. So he would, in order for his team to win, he had to stand on one leg and hold his arms like. He did that for like 36 hours one time.
That's impressive.
That's impressive.
And sad at the same time. But also, was his name Nomar Garcia Parra? Because that would make a lot of sense to me.
Right. That would.
That's an old reference for those or your older listeners.
He's got a has a little investment in why he wants that game to come out, right?
Right, right.
Slight amount of investment. That might be that crossover of perfectionism and OCD right there, you know.
Yeah. That's a magical thing. But, that's a signal of OCD for sure.
But I think the lay public, you know, they use OCD to talk about perfectionism. That's there's this loose kind of association there without a differentiation. And I think it's like you say, you heard me ask a question that's never been asked, because a lot of people don't make these connections between something that they use in their common terminology and something that people, you know, experience at clinical levels. It's terrible. That's impacting their lives. Now, when you, you know, as you went into this audience that it, that that experiences perfectionism, they might experience aspects of OCD, because there's this line where if they don't get it perfect, then they start having the thoughts and the thoughts become disturbing, right? Yeah. Yeah. And then it starts to become disorder when that person can't control the way that makes them feel.
Yes, absolutely.
How do you bridge this clinical information? Because this is a struggle that we all have, I think, as treatment professionals. How do you bridge a lot of this clinical information in a way that is receivable to folks that are on performance ends and management ends and kind of regular, quote unquote, regular public, right?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's really not easy. It's iterative. And one of the things that has been one of the biggest roadblocks to me getting out there is people assuming that because I'm a professor, I'm going to be boring as hell when I go up to talk about things.
I've seen you speak. You are not boring. I can say that.
I mean, people think that you're going to be just this really stuffy, esoteric, you know, and just even the word esoteric probably already makes me esoteric. But the idea is that people just assume this because it is a tough skill to translate some of this stuff to a lay audience. And it's, you know, it takes practice. It takes making mistakes and not being perfectionistic, so to speak, and going up there and, reading people's facial expressions and trying to be empathic and like, what is this person talking about? And being able to see that look on their face and going, wait, oh, this clearly did not hit. So let me rephrase that. But yeah, it's tough. And I think it helps to understand that perfectionism is on a continuum. There's more and less in everybody, right? We all have some elements of it. Maybe some people have very little, but some people have extreme paralyzing amounts of it. But most of us fall somewhere in the middle, and it doesn't really become debilitating until it gets in the way of your functioning and causes you not to do things, or maybe it causes tremendous stress for you and the people around you. And unless it's meeting that marker, it's just part of everyday experience. And so everyone sees perfectionism either in themselves or the people around them. And so that part hasn't been hard, right? People have an understanding of what I'm talking about once I get into it. Now, what they don't understand is the breadth or sort of the how far reaching this type of perfectionism goes. They see it as people being afraid to make mistakes. But as my book goes into Flawed, it really has tentacles that extend far, far out into all sorts of characteristics that I'm happy to dive into, but it tends to be this most surprising aspect of perfectionism when I speak to people.
Well, and you know, I have a background in doing management training and facilitating experience-based training and development. So this whole aspect of bridging over into management is really, really interesting to me. And so we start to dive into territory from person's psychological health to an organization's psychological health.
Right.
And that, you know, when a person is experiencing levels of perfectionism that start to dance on the edge of disordered, you know, yes, they're taking it a little too far.
Yeah.
One thing is a lot of the people that are working for them or that they're leading can't follow them there.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. It's, you see it, organizations are people, right? In general. So right. If you have, you know, the people, you know, often think that there's something special, but they're really just, they're made up of people, right? And so, yes, you need to think about social dynamics in addition to individual dynamics, but you definitely can have a massive impact on the organization with a display of perfectionistic tendencies. I mean, you see it all the time. I mean, perhaps one of the biggest thing that I see with perfectionism is procrastination, right? Because people get stuck and they don't want to work on things because they're so anxious.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, we'll get to it later. We'll get to it later. But and of course, procrastination just brings everything to a grinding halt. But not even just procrastination, even just slowed processes, just an absolute slowdown because you're trying to find the perfect process, the most efficient, the most effective. And of course, the irony is that in doing so, you've just slowed yourself down to a grinding halt, the most ineffective or inefficient. And so you get these cogs in the wheel that just bring everything down to a halt. And that is extremely costly for organizations.
And that's a dollar. There's a dollar value on that. Yeah.
And the other area that people forget is turnover. If you're working for a perfectionist and they are rigid and rule bound rather than principle bound and project moralistic standards on other people, like they expect you to and should be a certain way, it's a hard environment to work for someone that's self-righteous and sanctimonious, which is what that looks like. And so you get a lot of turnover. You get a ton. And of course, that's been quantified. That's not cheap in any fashion.
Well, and you're also talking about, you know, you go over to the development side, there's all the, you know, Peter Senge and Tom Peters and all these guys, they talk about like the ladder of inference, for example. It's, you're assigning a person, when they start to go over a line in perfectionism, there's a values assignment to it. You know, perfect has a meaning. Yes. It's not just a mark. It's not just a benchmark for people to achieve. Hey, this is a standard of quality we want to achieve. You know, if you're a manufacturer, you're an engineer, standards of quality are part and parcel for your world, right? So that's healthy. That's okay. But then you start to assign meaning and value to a perfectionistic standard. If it starts to go over the line, it's almost like you get, it's almost like an organization can really get lost. How do you, in your mind, like, how do you treat that? Like, how do you treat that with an organization?
Yeah, you first
and have the person. Out, you know?
Yeah, right. I don't know that they're dramatically different in terms of what you would need to do. But you first would need to dissect and figure out where this is happening. You know, in my adventures getting the word out about perfectionism in organizations, I've really learned that you don't see a ton of it at the tippy top of the organization. You don't see a lot of it at the CEO level. Because you just really self-select. You can't be a CEO and be terribly perfectionistic. You have to be willing to take quick failures and learn and move on. And for the most of the CEOs that I've talked to, and there have been a lot of them, the idea of perfectionism, they've had the hardest time understanding it because they're like, I don't understand people who are perfectionistic. They're just, it's not in their blood. However, you go one notch down into the C-suite, CFOs, you know, CTOs, CHOs, they are the perfectionists, right? Because
highly perfectionistic, right?
Yeah. And so the CEOs actually, when you see a perfectionist CEO, that does not last very long. I've heard stories about this where the entire organization just grinds to a halt. Way too rigid, not innovative, not risk-taking, hard to work for people like that because of the should statements that come with the perfectionism, like you should do it this way, you should do it that way. Just that really brings down the morale of the entire organization. It's really when you get a healthy organization where at the top you have some flexibility and some of what you described, striving for perfection, but not holding yourself to that value, and striving is not the same thing as perfectionism. Striving for excellence is not the same thing, right? And so when you start to see that, that's when you get into the organization, you have to find the pinpoints of where this is occurring, certain leadership, certain processes and funnels within the organization. You can find pretty quickly where the slow points are and where the grinds are. And that's where you need to start talking about how this impacts teams and the process and providing strategies and new frameworks for thinking about this. And some of those frameworks are at the culture level, not just at the individual level.
I mean, you talk about cognitive behavioral therapy, you know, really in the end, for an organization. So my question to you is, and I'm super this is a topic that I have a lot of interest in and have done lots of reading on and everything else. So I'm really curious about some of the stuff that you do. Like, what is the delivery for an organ? Like, I know what cognitive behavioral therapy looks like for an individual.
Yep.
But what is the delivery for an organization? What is a CBT-based strategy delivery intervention look like for an organization?
I'm glad you asked. That's a great question. Also one I've never heard before. No, it's good because people don't understand what CBT is or how it translates. And that was a great question. I'll give you a great example because my entire book and the strategies in there are based on evidence-based approaches like CBT, acceptance and commitment therapy, essentially exposure and response prevention, which is the gold standard treatment.
Little ERP for people.
A little ERP for OCD and anxiety disorders, which is, you know, we're talking success rates in the 80 to 90%. I mean, that's unheard of in most mental health treatments, right? And so I would be stupid not to try to translate those principles and strategies to an organization. And that's exactly what I've done.
Well, or lazy. You might be just lazy, you know? you might not want to do it.
Right? Yeah, right. And so what I've done is really tried to create a framework and language that doesn't dive heavy into the clinical jargon and essentially camouflages the principles in a way that seem palatable for people in an organization that don't want to be labeled with some sort of horrible diagnosis and don't want, you know, they don't want to even think about this as a mental health treatment. And so I'll give you an example. I use something called the emphasis framework for helping organizations and individuals. The emphasis framework, if you really boil it down, is exposure and response prevention. But I don't tell people that, right? Even though I just told the entire public that right now in this podcast.
Right.
But essentially, what I do is I think about tasks in three different buckets. There's emphasis A, emphasis B, and emphasis C. All right. Emphasis A is the give it everything you got, 110%. Right. This is truly where you put your energy, your effort, everything. Then there's emphasis B, the get her done strategy. Just get her done. Doesn't need to be perfect. Doesn't need to be garbage. Probably for things that just need to get done that you can't completely ignore. Right. Then there's emphasis C, which is the let's not do it at all strategy. Right. Like, let's just skip it. And there's a time and place for all three of these. I am completely agnostic to judgment or criticism because there's really truly an adaptive time for each of these. Right. And it's based on your values, what's really important to you or your organization. Right. So if you're planning your wedding and that's really important to you, if you're trying to study to get into med school, the MCAT test might be really important for you to give it 110%. You know, whenever I go on podcasts, I give it 110%, you know, those kinds of things. But you can't do that for everything. There's just not enough resource, right? Emphasis C, I'm going to skip B for a second. Emphasis C also has a time and place. Just not everything is worth your time and energy.
We're just not going to do that. Right.
Right. I never open my junk mail, right in the recycling. I never answer the customer service satisfaction survey at the end of my call with Verizon. Sorry, Verizon. Is Verizon a sponsor on your podcast? I'm so sorry.
You know, we'll have to dub that out and talk to Verizon. Yeah. If they're willing to give us some dollars for the promo, then maybe we can keep it.
Okay,
in, right?
Very good. But these are things that it's just not worth my time. I've determined based on my values that I just don't necessarily want to do those things. Now, occasionally I will if I want to say something, but it's just not worth my time. So I'll purposely emphasis C that based on strategy, based on values, right? Emphasis B is where most things typically fall to be adaptive because a common pattern among people with perfectionism or in organizations with perfectionism is that everything becomes emphasis A. There's no way of sort of figuring out and triaging where tasks go. And so they try to emphasis A everything. And what happens is that that's just not possible. And so things get forced or pushed into emphasis C, not because of your values, but because of your anxiety and perfectionism.
You lost your time and your energy. And you didn't make an intentional decision about it in advance.
Exactly. And so your anxieties and perfectionism is driving everything in the organization or in your individual task list. And so what I do is I go in there and I talk about, let's do some exercises where we start to put these tasks into buckets to essentially prioritize. And then you're going to purposefully do things in an emphasis B way where you typically would want to do them emphasis A. right? That is camouflaged exposure therapy. I know it's
That's
hard.
That's pretty cool. The question that occurs to me is, you know, I think about the companies that I've worked with in the past. I spent a decade doing corporate facilitation, from engineers to CEOs and everything else. And I think about, like, what are the things that we processed when we, you know, because experiential methodologies is ultimately this microcosm environment. Let's give you a problem to solve it, and let's watch how you solve it.
Yeah.
And let's talk about the problems you experience, the frustration. How does that translate to your work world? What are some solutions that you have for adjusting your culture so this works better, right? And I'm having a hard time thinking of a place where, you know, this approach that you're talking about doesn't fit.
I know, because it fits at the individual level. And what are organizations? Just a bunch of individuals, right? And so I've seen this work in my therapy office tremendously. And I'm like, why would this not translate? Of course it translates, right?
Well, I mean, you're also talking about, you're talking about human behavioral stuff, right. Obviously. Right. And sometimes you have people unable to manage conflicts. Sometimes there's personality, you know, divides that happen within an organization. But in many ways, they're kind of, like you say, they're this values misalignment. And it's almost, if you go into a conflict model, you know, conflict model looks pretty close to the model you're talking about. You've got collaborative conflict resolution approaches. You've got avoidant conflict, you know, it's like, yep. And, you know, either I'm going to force my way and get my way.
Yep.
I'm going to negotiate some kind of middle in between, or I'm going to avoid the problem entirely. Like, yep. You're talking about the same model, essentially.
Yeah. Well, yours is more of an interpersonal model, right? And that is something, sure, I talk about in the book. I get into this when I really talk about, in my world, we call that assertiveness training, right? Like, how do you interact with people in a way that doesn't cost you too much social capital, but also makes you feel like you're self-respecting, right? How do you compromise? How do you do things that don't cost you too much, but also don't cost you in your self-worth? And this is very much related to kind of what you're describing. And yeah, it's, again, another way of translating what I see in the clinical world into an organizational setting. And in this particular example, what you're describing very well could have originated in the corporate world and has influenced the clinical world in the other direction, because I do think that there's a back and forth between what, you know, quote unquote, the real world and the clinical world, right?
Well, and you got to speak to working with individuals, not only suffering from OCD, but also on the spectrum,
yes,
at our conference. And talked about some approaches that were interesting, including the use of AI. Mm-hmm. And this interpersonal measure that goes into the rigidity and some of the OCD and everything else, we see that in organizational environments. We definitely
Absolutely.
Do. And I think we're seeing a lot more, honestly. Like, I think we're seeing a culture of people. We're seeing, you know, millennials and all the gens, mm-hmm, down from Gen X, of course. We're perfect.
Right. Can't beat that generation.
No, you can't beat that generation. Leave those guys alone.
Right. But
all the, you know, all these folks are coming out, and there's, you know, we could talk about screens, and we're talking about anxiety, and we could talk about all these kind of conditions, and they take them into the work world, and you see all these problems arising.
Absolutely.
That are behavioral, but they're all rooted in a lot of this stuff, which is, you know, a person has a values alignment, mm-hmm, here's a great example, I think, that we see in the world. And I'd love to hear your thoughts about this, but, gender identity.
Yes.
You've got a large component of our society that's, you know, very offended the moment that they get, you know, misgendered, dead named, you know, slighted,
yes,
ultimately in any way. And a lot of what I see, at least, you know, I'm not a person who struggles with this. I have a very personal connection to this topic myself, because I have family members who are trans. But the thing that happens for them is they don't experience the world in the same way. I'm thankful for that, because it looks very hard.
Right.
They don't experience the world as constantly assaulting them, yeah. as constantly offending them, and mm-hmm. trying to make the world. In fact, I have clients right now that, you know, their orientation, the world needs to understand me. And if they don't validate me, then it's for naught. Right. You know, that they go pretty far down into these dark holes with that stuff.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, there's perfectionism in there.
Oh yeah. I agree. And I very much appreciate you bringing up very light topics today. Very non-charged.
I told you this wasn't a gotcha interview. You know what I mean?
Okay, Katie Couric, are you trying to cancel both of us at the same time?
I'm not saying people should be misgendered. I'm not proposing that at all.
I'm just playing with you. It actually dovetails very nicely into another area of perfectionism that I think is misunderstood and underappreciated, which is people with perfectionistic tendencies get hyper-focused on rules. And at the expense of sometimes the underlying principles on which those rules are based, meaning they get rigid around things needing to be done a certain way because they quote unquote should be that way. And they sort of approach rules as universal truths, right? But often they lose sight of the principles that underlie those rules. I always give a really dumb example of this, right? So you're at the
dumb examples. I need them.
Yeah. Well, you're at the community pool. It's summertime. I know it's hard because it's winter right now, but imagine you're at the summer pool or the community pool in the summer, and you see a kid drowning, and you look to your right and the lifeguards are, you know, flirting with each other as they do and not paying attention. And you look to the left and the parents are on their cell phones, not paying attention as they do. And you're like, oh crap, this is up to me. So you start running towards the pool and you look down and you decide to let the kid drown. And someone comes up to you afterwards and says, why the hell did you do that? You could have saved that kid. And the person says, or you say, oh, I'm sorry, I ate within 30 minutes. And it says no swimming within 30 minutes of eating. Right there on the rules. And now, first of all,
There was no running. And I
there's no running. So I ambled up to the pool and walked. So, you know, first of all, I have to explain that sometimes pools have rules that say you can't eat before going in the pool within 30 minutes. Because apparently, and I learned this from the Red Cross, that rule is totally bogus. That is a totally mythical, like that is not true. Apparently they don't want you to cramp up and drown, but Red Cross says that that's bogus. Anyway, so feel free to eat as many.
Really, they just don't want you to have, they don't want you to, there was another reason, up in I the don't pool. Remember what yeah, it was. Yeah, right, yeah. right. It's something. Yeah.
But the idea here is that there's a rule that you so rigidly followed that you lost sight of the principle on which that rule was based. The principle there is public safety, right? Or the value is public safety. And the principle is let's all be safe in the community pool, right?
Let's help others if they're in need, right? You know.
And but what did you do when you let the kid drown? Well, you completely violated that value and that principle. So you were so adherent to this rule that you actually violated the principle that served to create that rule in the first place. And so I know it's a really dumb example, but it illustrates what I'm trying to explain because I see this everywhere. Oh,
and the other thing is that the person probably thinks that, you know, don't go in the pool before 30 minutes of eating. That's the value. They've misplaced them.
Yes, exactly. They get hyper-focused on that rule, or they believe that that is the unspoken truth about reality that needs to, that somehow it cannot be broken. It's as, you know, and that's the problem is that's not how the world works. Rules are suggestions, and I'm not saying we should get rid of rules, right? But rules don't always make the most sense. And people have done a ton of research on this, looking at that, you know, the classic problem of would you steal medicine to save your wife? You know, it's stealing. It's quote unquote illegal. It's not quote unquote illegal. It is illegal, right? You're taking someone else's property. Is that morally wrong? Maybe, but you're saving your wife. Is it permissible? And so it's this classic question. And the problem is that people on the spectrum, for example, or people with perfectionism that get really rigid, or people with OCD that get really rigid, they sometimes have a really hard time and they get stuck on these rules and they can't act on the principles, especially when they violate those rules. And what makes it even worse is when they project those standards onto other people. So if you—
And they start expecting them, you know, exactly. The same behavior, right.
So you are walking around telling people that they need to be at work on time And instead you see it as they need to be working exactly at 7 o'clock. And if they show up at 7:01 and you're policing them, you're not going to make a lot of friends. Right. And yeah. You're missing the point. What if that person had a flat tire and they made it in at 7:01? That's pretty damn good. You know what I mean?
Well, early's the new late, right? So whatever.
Yeah, whatever. And so you're walking around policing people on moralistic and rigid morals. Like you're going to have a really hard time in a culture like that, keeping people, and you're going to have a hard time making friends.
Yeah. And I think that you also, you know, in the world where a person may not be in management, but they're experiencing these challenges, they end up, what I'm seeing, this is interesting to me. I think, honestly, you may or may not know of Jordan Peterson, and mm-hmm. I'm not trying to promote the guy or anything like that.
Yeah.
But you know, he and the trans folks they've gotten into it. He says this, and he's not wrong, because he says the same thing that you and I just talked about, which is, you know, when you start observing rules in. You know, without looking at the greater picture, you know, it's like, we're going to force everyone to observe, you know, gender, when, you know, you've got to observe a person's gender. It's like, if you make rules about people having to say things or do things like this, that's actually dictatorial, and you're establishing a dictatorial environment. He's not wrong. Like, you're misplacing the spirit of what we need to do, which is accept people and do all these things. But what his response is, if you see these exchanges that he has, is that he's a complete jerk. I mean, he comes at them with this, like, and you are not analytical enough to be seeing the root of your problem. And he actually gives them a response, while not inaccurate, from the spirit of it and the delivery of it and everything else, lands utterly flat and disenfranchises everybody that he's talking to.
So, well, hypocritical, because he's doing the very thing that he's blaming them for.
Right. Right?
He's getting stuck on his moral crusade, and he's not, right?
Right, right. He's like, you're not looking at the entire problem. I can't even talk to you. You're so dysregulated. You know, he's dissing this person. He's a psychologist. I'm like, dude, you're a jerk. It's what you are.
That's the kind of self-righteousness and sanctimony that I think people can look like when they're getting stuck on these moral rules, right?
And so we get this almost a cacophony of these reactions in our world that's happening. I can imagine that in an organization that hanks production really quickly.
Yeah.
You can't get anywhere. You can't get anything done, right?
Right. What's one of the biggest stressors in any environment is going to be interpersonal dynamics, right? And
right.
Interpersonal stress.
So what's the, you know, and with a little bit of time we have, I'm sure we spend a lot of time on this topic, because I'm super curious about it. And I love to hear about the work that you're doing with organizations and people in general. But, you know, when we talk about interpersonal dynamics, if we approach it this frame that you've named, what's the intervention in a social dynamic, in a social environment, say in a work environment? What is the intervention for folks like that, and for the culture? Like, how would you approach that?
Well, a lot of it then comes back to how to dress up evidence-based cognitive behavior therapy approaches. So to come full circle, a lot of the work that I'll do on these things like rules versus principles versus values, and being careful with approaching people in a moralistic way and how to do so differently, and approaching it from an assertive framework, a lot of it is based on CBT and some of the things we do in, for example, acceptance and commitment therapy, or in cognitive therapy, where we break down assumptions about how the world works, right? And
even if you're rapid resolution, I mean, there's a little rapid resolution sounds like.
Yes, there is some of that as well. Right. And so it really comes down to helping people change their worldview. And sometimes you do that through behavior, and sometimes you do that through Socratic questioning and teaching them a different framework. And so everything that I do in organizations stems from the work that we do in the therapy office. It just isn't called that because I think it's not necessarily the same. I'm not treating disorders, so to speak. And you got to approach this a little bit more delicately, because this is a work setting, and it needs to be palatable for groups, not just individuals, right? And so, but I will sneakily put in evidence-based, right? Because when we talk about control, I talk about a control a whole lot because I think a lot of